This evening, we're going to start a series in the book of Esther. This book is one of the favourites of the Jewish people because of the story that it tells of how a man wanting to destroy them as a nation was confounded by really this young heroine, Esther. It also introduces to the Jews the Feast of Purim, which is a feast they still hold today in remembrance of this very event when the nation was delivered once again and saved from extinction, really. We're going to just do an introduction to the book this evening. It's a book that's quite unique in the Bible. It's the only book in the Bible that does not mention God specifically. It's the only book where you do not see the name of God anywhere in the whole book, and it's quite unique in that respect. Although, as we shall see as we look through this book together, God is directing everything that goes on. He's directing the lives and the people, and his plans and purposes are being worked out through these people in this book. Because of the fact that God isn't mentioned, many people have thought that it shouldn't be included as part of the Christian canon, as part of the scriptures that we have today for our Christian beliefs. Martin Luther, notably, did not like the idea of Esther being included because it did not mention God. But it's there, it's in Scripture, and I believe it's right that it should be, and I think we'll see as we go through it. Even though the name of God is not mentioned specifically, there's much we can learn from it. So tonight, really, is going to be an introduction and an overview. And so nothing more than that. I won't get to all those long names tonight, and you'll be pleased to know, and I'm very pleased to know. what we're going to look at tonight is the historical background, just so we get it in the context of what's going on, so that we can understand the relationship to history, especially the history of Israel, so we can know the political situation, that we can understand what's going on, the circumstances surrounding this story of Esther. We'll look at the major characters in the book tonight, just an introduction to them. And we'll just have a quick overview of the whole story. And we're going to note some of the themes and some of the parallels that actually can apply to the church today. And we'll explore that, obviously, in greater depth as we go through the book. So tonight, we're not going to go into major detail on these things, but we're going to introduce these things tonight and things we can look forward to over the next few weeks and probably months as we look through this book together. What I would encourage you to do is to go away and read it. It's not very long. It's quite a short book, really. It's a superb story in itself as a narrative of what went on. It's a great story. It's one of those things you could publish as a story today, and it would probably be, you know, well received as a book in its own right. But of course, it's historical fact, and we mustn't forget that either. This is something that really did happen. So please go away tonight or throughout the week and read this story so that when we do start looking into it in more depth and more detail, you're going to have a good idea of what's going on. I want to start with chapter 1 and verse 1 tonight, which is a good place to start. And this is what it says. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. Now, though the subject of the book is Esther, she is the sort of heroine of the whole book, the story is much wider than that. It's a story about the treatment, the persecution of God's people and God's deliverance from that persecution. It's the providence of God. We see God working out through his people. And it's a tremendous story to seeing, you know, if you like, God working in the background of people's lives. It's got parallels with other areas of Jewish history. Particularly, you could probably think of the story of Joseph and how God's people then in a foreign land, as Joseph was taken to Egypt and then his family followed into Egypt, and how God raised up Joseph at the right time to be the right person in the right place to ensure the deliverance of God's people right there at the beginning of the nation of Israel. And it's got, if you understand the literary content of Hebrew, you'll understand there are similarities in the literary content between those two stories. There's some great similarities between them. But God raises up this person, Esther, to meet the needs of his people. So let's have a look just for quickly at the historical background. What's going on here? And we need to just get this into perspective, if you like, in the timeline of the nation of Israel. Firstly, you'll remember that the kingdom was united under King David. King David brought everything together. He centered it on Jerusalem, and he brought the kingdom to be one people. And there was a great time of peace and prosperity in the nation of Israel under King David, and also following him under Solomon. But it wasn't long after Solomon's death, the kingdom was divided into the north and the south, the Israel in the north and the tribe of Judah in the south. And the kingdom then became divided, and there were all sorts of problems between the two, as well as with other nations surrounding them. The Assyrians became the dominant world power and were always a threat to the nation of Israel. Those of you who did Jonah in the house groups will be reminded of the fact of Nineveh, in the capital of the Assyrian Empire, and how the Assyrians were not particularly nice people, and they were very keen to bring under their control the surrounding nations, and the Assyrian kingdom became very large and very powerful. But God told them that their kingdom would fall, and it did, of course. It fell to the Babylonians, and they were the next great empire that came along under King Nebuchadnezzar. And at that time, we have the exile, where Nebuchadnezzar conquers Israel, and he takes the people into exile, into Babylon. And we read all about that, of course, during the time of Daniel and the book of Daniel. We can read there how the Israelites were taken into captivity. This was followed by the rise of the Persian Empire, which is where we're going to be looking at in this book of Esther. The Persian Empire became the next dominant world power. Nebuchadnezzar was told this would happen, wasn't he? He was given that dream of the statue and how the various kingdoms would come about. And also later on in the feast Belshazzar had, and the writing came on the wall, didn't it? And he was told, basically, you know, your kingdom's going to fall to the Medes and the Persians. And that's exactly what happened. And the Persian Empire became the next dominant power. So this book of Esther is set at the time when the Jews, many of the Jews, are still in exile. Some of the Jews have returned home. They were led home by Zerubbabel. And some of them have gone home and back to Jerusalem at the time this story takes place. But the majority were still living in exile under Persian rule. It's contemporary with the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. These three books detail the times around the exile and also the return to Jerusalem and the rebuilding of the temple and the walls. Ezra is basically about the rebuilding of the temple and the rediscovery of the book of the law. Remember that tremendous time when Ezra gets the book of the law and he spends all day reading it, and all the people are fascinated and you know, dumbfounded at what is written there in the law. And so it's about bringing the people back to obedience. And that's what the book of Ezra really is about, rediscovering the law and the people returning to God. Nehemiah, of course, is about the rebuilding of the city walls and the opposition that they faced as they did that. And a few years after the events of this book, Esther, it's when Ezra led some more people back to Jerusalem. And then a bit later on, Nehemiah led, again, the majority of the exiles back home to their own nation. So this story is set at a time when the Jews were living in a foreign land. They were a foreign people, displaced, if you like. They were the outsiders in this foreign land. They'd integrated in many ways. Many of them, like Daniel, for instance, had gone up through the ranks, if you like, into the quite exalted positions in the nation itself. So the Israelites, although they were still exiles, they were still perhaps considered to be oppressed. They were living in many ways quite happily in this Persian Empire. So the Persian Empire then is established. And this is the extent of it as we read here in verse 1. King Xerxes, who ruled the empire, ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India over to Kush. Kush being northern part there of the Nile region, Ethiopia. Well, not modern-day Ethiopia, but Ethiopia as it was then. So it's quite an extensive kingdom. You know, it's quite a big empire. And it was very, very powerful. And this is the world power at the time. And it's led by this king, Ahasuerus, if you've got King James or some of the older versions. That's his Hebrew name, King Ahasuerus. King Xerxes is his Greek name. It's the same name translated into Greek, and it's the name by which he's probably best known, certainly in historical literature. And he reigned from 486 to 464 BC, and he reigned in this great empire that stretched from India all the way over to Africa. Let's have a look at some of the main characters that are involved here. Cool. We've mentioned the first one, King Xerxes, introduced in the very first verse here. And it declares, doesn't it, his vast dominion. It tells us what a great king he is, right there in the first verse. And the first chapter that we've read together goes on to detail his wealth and his opulence and, you know, how he displayed, you know, his vast wealth to the people and how he made a real big show of what a great king he was and how much he had. And yet that was in stark contrast to most of the people in the day who didn't have very much. They lived in almost abject poverty in many places in his kingdom. And yet this man had all this opulence and this splendour and this greatness that he liked to show off. His father was Darius, and it was during the reign of Darius that the temple in Jerusalem was rebuilt, which was completed in 516 BC. His grandfather was Cyrus, who you remember was very benevolent to the Israelites and foreign captives when he was king, and he was known for his benevolence and for his generosity to the foreigners. Xerxes himself was twice defeated as he tried to take over Greece. He attacked Greece, and twice he tried, and twice he was defeated when he tried to conquer them. And there's a book that was written by a Greek historian whose name was Herodotus, and it's a book called The Histories, and it details a lot of the history of that period, and it details the Persian Empire at this time. And one third of that book for histories is devoted to this king Xerxes, and it tells us a lot about him. We have a lot of information about this king. There are lots of tablets from the era as well that were discovered in archaeological digs around the time that also give us great detail about the empire and about, again, the kings and in particular Xerxes. So we've got a great amount of detail given historically and archaeologically about this whole empire. And it ties in very, very nicely with this book of Esther. You know, we shouldn't expect otherwise, should we? This is God's word. But it does. It fits in very well. And it gives very good descriptions of the king. And it seems to be this king was a man who loved to show off and yet constantly needed reassurance of his advisors when making decisions. And we can see that even in the first chapter here, that he needed those things. And this was a man who was manipulated, wasn't he? He was manipulated, as we see through this story, by Haman, who got him to issue the edict to have the Jews wiped out, and he was manipulated into doing that. And actually, the turning point of the whole story focuses on this king, on King Xerxes. Chapter 6, the whole turning point is when he couldn't get to sleep one night, and that's where the whole story turns on its head. And I'm not going to go into that now, but that's something we can look forward to seeing, where this whole story is changed simply because this king couldn't get to sleep one night. Who else is there? Mordecai, a Jew from the tribe of Benjamin. His name comes from the Babylonian god Marduk. That's where his name comes from. And again, his name is mentioned actually in some ancient Arabic writings, where a man named Marduka served King Xerxes at the citadel of Susa. And it's quite likely that it's referring to Mordecai. He was a man who revealed a plot against the king, and he saved the king's life, basically. And he was a man who trusted in God, looked to God, and he categorically believed that even in the midst of the terrible situation that was going to come upon the people here, that God would deliver the Jewish people. He believed it. He told Esther that she was the person to do this, but he said, even if you don't do it, God will do it from somewhere else. God will meet the needs of his people. He was a man of faith. He trusted in God, and he trusted that God would save his people. Then, of course, Esther, the main character in the book, really. Her Hebrew name is Hadassah. Hadassah means myrtle. And myrtle, of course, I'm sure you all know, is a type of tree. And if you look at some of the prophetic writings, Isaiah chapter 41, verse 19, and Isaiah 55, verse 13, there's a passage there that says that myrtle will replace the briars and the thorns. The desert will bloom with myrtle trees. And it symbolizes, the myrtle tree symbolizes the forgiveness of God. And they still carry myrtle branches when they have the Feast of Tabernacles today, which signifies the peace and thanksgiving. So her name is a way of showing God's forgiveness and his love towards his people. Esther is the Persian equivalent of that name, Hadassah. In the Persian tongue, it sounds like the Hebrew. And that means star, where we get the name Stella from as well. And it's possibly a reference to the star-shaped flowers that the myrtle tree produces. So it's a name which really says God is going to forgive the people. He's going to look after the people. So her name is also very important in this book. She was Mordecai's cousin, a much younger cousin. And he brought her up, basically. She was an orphan. Her parents had died. And he looked after her and brought her up. And she was very beautiful, we're told. And eventually she becomes queen. And through that position, she's able to help her people. Although, it still could have cost her life to do what she did. So again, that's Esther. And we'll obviously look more at her as we go through it. And then the fourth main character is Haman. Haman the Agagite, who is introduced in chapter 3. Someone who clearly desires to get on in life. He wanted to move up the social scale. He wanted to get on into a high position in government, and he does. He gets promoted to be second in command to the king. And as his name indicates, an Agagite, he was descendant of Agag, king of the Amalekites, who we read about in chapter 15 of 1 Samuel. There in chapter 15 of 1 Samuel, we're reminded that Saul, who was told to wipe this king and everything out, didn't do that. He spared this king's life, and because of that, Saul was condemned by God. His kingdom was taken from him eventually. And we're told about the Amalekites, they did not fear God. They did not consider God. They didn't even believe in God. And so this man, Haman, it seems, follows that tradition. He's an Agagite. He's a descendant of the Amalekite king. And it seems that he, too, had no consideration for God. After his promotion, he expected everybody to bow down to him. He wanted everybody to give him due reverence. And yet Mordecai refused to do so. And the result was that Haman thought he's so angry, he was going to wipe out not just Mordecai, but his whole nation, all the Jews. And that was what he planned to do. So he tricks the king into signing a decree to do that, to get the Jews exterminated. But it all goes wrong, and he ends up getting executed on his own gallows. Well, I don't want to ruin the ending for you just yet. What was going on then? The Jews were facing persecution, weren't they? They faced persecution because they were different. If you read chapter 4 of the book of Ezra, you read in there how they were facing opposition then. And it talks about during the reign of Xerxes how the Jews faced opposition. It was because they worshipped differently, because they kept perhaps themselves to themselves in many ways. They didn't follow the Persian ways of doing things. They didn't follow the Persian gods. They were different. And that caused problems for them, and it caused opposition. Chapter 3 of Esther tells us there of Haman's anger and his desire to kill the Jews because of what Mordecai did and because they were different. And of course, the Jews, as we know, have faced such opposition all through history. We read it all through the Old Testament. We've seen it in recent history, haven't we? We've seen things like the Holocaust and things like that, where people have tried to exterminate the Jewish race. But of course, the church also faces similar opposition. And it faces difficulties. And that's where we find some of the parallels for today. Parallels that remind us that what the Jews had to face, we have to face perhaps in other ways. They got comfortable where they were. They had the chance to go back to Jerusalem with Zerubbabel, but they didn't want to, most of them. They were happy. They were comfortable. They were settled. I wonder if we have become too comfortable where we are today. Have we become settled in a world that really is not our home? As Christians, we are actually in exile at the moment. We're not where we should be. We're not where God designed us to be. We're supposed to be with Him in glory. We're supposed to reside with God. So at the moment, we're not at home. We're in a world that really should be quite foreign to us. But I wonder, have we become too comfortable? One of the things we're going to look at as we look through this book. Is God only in the background of our lives? God's not mentioned by name in this book, although we know He's working in this background. But is God only in the background of our lives? Does He have the forefront of our thoughts and our minds? Does everything that we do on a daily basis revolve around our relationship with God? Are we always seeking to put God first and desiring to follow Him? Or is God someone we just bring out on a Sunday and lives in the background of our lives? Again, we're going to explore that as we look through this book together. And we too are foreigners in this land, and we too will face hostility. In fact, we do face hostility, don't we? There's many things that go on today where the Christian faith is under attack, and in this country, there's the militant atheists who want to wipe Christianity from the face of the earth, not just Christianity, but religion in general. That is a stated aim of people like Richard Dawkins. He wants to remove Christianity completely. I read a quote from an atheist in America, a very prominent atheist in America the other day, and it absolutely shocked me when I read this quote. He said, if I could get rid of rape or religion, I'd get rid of religion without a shadow of doubt. He saw things like rape as evolutionary consequences of the way we live, but he saw religion as dangerous. It's amazing. This is the sort of hostility that Christians are facing today. We may not be suffering the physical persecutions that perhaps people elsewhere in this world are for their faith, but make no mistake about it, we are under attack in this country from the forces of darkness, and we are under attack from people who would love to see Christianity wiped from the face of the earth. Of course, it's not going to happen. It didn't happen in Haman's time when he tried it, and it won't happen today. But we need to be prepared for this. We need to be on our guard for this. We need to be ready for these things when they occur. And all too often, we can read in the Bible, can't we? We can see that there will be problems in the last days. There will be troubles. There will be persecutions. There will be tribulation. And we're not really prepared for it because we read it, but we don't think it applies to us. It's for somebody else a bit later on. We're quite comfortable, aren't we? We're quite happy in the situation we found ourselves. But make no mistake, there is hostility and persecution coming our way. And we're going to look at how God deals with His people there and how God today will deal with us in the face of such things. Let me conclude tonight, or conclude my introduction tonight. We haven't got too far through it, as you've probably noticed, but with some encouragement from this book as well. Even though we might sometimes feel a bit too comfortable in this world, even though we may possibly relegate God to the background of our lives occasionally, Even though we will face hostility and persecution, this book tells us that God is still working his purposes out. God is in control. God is in charge of all that goes on. He is the unseen hand that directs people's lives. And God will work his purposes out in our lives. And I want to just tell you what I believe is the key verse in the whole of this book. It's in chapter 4, and it's the end of verse 14. And it says this. Who knows, this is Mordecai speaking to Esther, who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this. God raises up the right person at the right time. And God will raise up today the people that are needed for such a time as this. And you may be those people. You may be in a position that God has raised you up and put you in for his purposes. Esther was not anybody special. She was a poor orphan girl who literally had nothing. And yet God, in his providence, raised her up, made her into the person he wanted her to be, so that she could fulfill his purposes at exactly the right time. And God never fails. God does nothing by accident. Everything God does is by design and purpose. And God will raise up the people he wants right at the right time to do his will and his purposes. And you may be that person. Are you looking to God to see what he desires for your life? Are you seeking to know where he's guiding and directing you? Because you may be raised up for a purpose. And that purpose may not be a great purpose like Esther's. It may be quite a simple thing. Who knows? But God has plans and purposes for all of our lives. And all of us are not in the positions we're in by mistake. We're here to serve God and to glorify him, just as Esther and Mordecai did.